Tuesday, September 13th, and we have 5 cases on our calendar today. This is the 3rd case we are hearing. My name is Sarah Wheelock, and I am the presiding judge today, serving on a panel with judges Diane Bratvold and Jeannie Cochran. And we're holding our hearings in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. The oral arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio recordings are generally available within 24 hours on the Minnesota Judicial Branch's website. So with that, Marshall, please call the next case.
This is case number A220001, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Ryan Edward Pulley, Appellant.
Counsel, as you both probably know, you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer on the center podium, and I see you've already adjusted it for your height, so feel free to get comfortable up there. The clock will run down your time, and at the beginning of your argument, please introduce yourselves clearly and identify the party that you represent so our recording is clear. Counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Coley Garosh, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Ryan Edward Pulley. Mr. Pulley respectfully requests that you vacate the convictions in this case due to the fact that there was insufficient evidence for a rational jury to convict, as well as the right to a fair trial was infringed due to the closing arguments of the state's attorney. As far as the insufficient evidence, the defense did move for a judgment of acquittal at the close of the state's case. Additionally, even with the additional evidence during the defense, the defendant did take the stand. Next, the improper closing arguments, there was some commentary about not only misstatements of the evidence by the state's attorney that I outlined in my brief, but also some commentary somewhat disparaging the defense. And so even if either one of these two issues independently didn't cause, wasn't error in Mr. Pulley's trial, certainly the cumulative effect of those errors warrant vacation of the convictions and remand to the district court. In this case, there was no physical evidence. There was the state's investigation attempted to find physical evidence and weren't able to do so. Now, I'm well aware of the state's position on the credibility issues. There is some case law that was discussed in both of our briefs that we have two situations here where the government could have discovered evidence and they failed to do so. There was That is absolutely true. However, as indicated in the transcript, the lack of evidence, when you have the scientist talking about the inspection of this item, the undergarments of the accuser, DW in this case, where they always look at the evidence for any physical signs of bodily fluids, and she testified that she regularly sees that. That completely contradicts what this witness testified to. So it's not merely the lack of corroborating evidence, it's more the contradictory evidence that the state presented that is relevant as far as credibility is concerned.
So, correct me if I'm wrong though, but I thought at the point that the expert was examining the evidence, it wasn't known that he didn't ejaculate.
That is correct. The witness never disclosed ejaculation during the initial investigation. So when law enforcement secured this garment for testing, there was never any indication they were looking for seminal fluid or any body fluids. However, the witness, the scientist did testify, the expert did testify that she visually inspected it, and there was no apparent signs of body fluid on the underwear that was tested. And furthermore,
and because of that, you're arguing that the evidence was insufficient?
Correct. And back to your point about, you know, acknowledging the statute that we don't, you know, I believe part of the rape shield laws that have been in place for a long time, an uncorroborated allegation of criminal sexual conduct is probable cause to charge. Corroboration isn't needed for a conviction, but this is, in fact, evidence that what was testified to did not occur. And there was a lot of testimony and questioning during the trial to nail down the exact time of when the accuser ejaculated and the circumstances of that. It was clear from the evidence that it was the last time that the allegations occurred or the assault of incidents occurred, and that the underwear he was wearing was secured for testing. In addition to that, DNA, although a little bit different because...
So, counsel, let me see if I'm following your reasoning. It seems to me that you're lining up this testimony to specifically test the credibility of the victim, as opposed to whether there is sufficient proof of the elements of the offense. Because seminal fluid's not required, is it, to prove an element of the offense?
It is not.
Okay. So help me understand how that goes to sufficiency of the evidence.
This isn't a case where the witness failed to testify to an essential element. There's no question that this witness testified to all the elements. So as far as the insufficiency of the evidence, it's whether that evidence was believable. I'm well aware of voluminous case law saying that it is the jury's decision as far as weighing credibility, and I know the appellate courts aren't to do that, but there is some indication in the case law that that's not always the case. It's not a kind of a clean slate. We never question the jury's gauging of credibility. We can look at the record, and certainly if there's evidence that's...
So what case law do you rely on for that? It's probably in your brief, and I'm just forgetting it right now.
I can find it. The name escapes me.
So you are going specifically to credibility of the victim?
As far as insufficiency of the evidence, yes.
Yeah.
We've never made an argument that the state failed to satisfy an essential element as far as some direct evidence, which would be the testimony here of DW. So when we take in the questionable credibility and the conflicting testimony with the evidence, and then we follow that up with the closing of the state's attorney. There's a lot of discussion about whether Mr. Poley was wearing a shirt at the time of this offense. The fact is that there was never any evidence to support any argument that Mr. Poley was in fact wearing a shirt, which somehow inhibited the transfer of his DNA. And that was the state's argument to push back on this idea that, you know, the expert indicated that they would expect some transfer of DNA in those circumstances. Certainly the absence of it doesn't mean it didn't happen. There it was, two or more profiles. One of those could have been Mr. Pulley. But in explaining why there wasn't DNA, they talk about this wearing a shirt, and the state in its brief indicates that, well, they were clearly talking about DW in this case, that there was evidence he was wearing a shirt, and that somehow the victim in this case, by wearing a shirt, would inhibit the transfer of Mr. Pulley's DNA in the undergarment and around the genital region, but the witness testified that there was skin-on-skin contact and there was no evidence that Mr. Pulley was wearing a shirt. So that is a, it is a misstatement of the evidence. Well,
so if the state argues that the prosecutor, well, not being as precise as the prosecutor could have done with the pronouns, was referring to DW and not Pulley.
I don't think that holds a lot. I don't think that argument holds a lot of water in the context of the case where we're talking about. You're familiar with the accusations. This boy is sleeping or half asleep and, you know, various stages of sleep, and the allegation is my client is then reaching under his pants and fondling him, sexually assaulting him. And so when they're talking about, you look in the transcript, there was a lot of discussion about secondary transfer of DNA and whether clothing or sleeves would inhibit that transfer of DNA, which the expert testified it would. We're talking about the lack of Mr. Pulley's DNA here. So for the state to make an argument that the garments, or at least the shirt around the arms and hands of the accuser in this situation would inhibit his DNA, that I guess I fail to understand how that makes any sense. Given the nature of the allegations and the evidence, it was clear the state was mistakenly arguing that Mr. Pulley had a shirt on, that is why his DNA did not appear as a major profile or a profile sufficient enough for analysis. And in addition to the misstatement of evidence, the state, as I argued, did belittle the defense in talking about any argument that can possibly be made, and including a red herring. I'm very familiar with case law. If the state can argue that our arguments are a red herring, we're trying to hide the ball, so to speak, that's certainly not improper. But by talking about we're basically throwing to see anything out there to see what sticks, belittles the nature of the defense. And in this case where we have these cases just are inherently emotionally charged. We have very serious allegations. We have very serious and allegations that many people are just uncomfortable even hearing about. And so the state needs to take special precautions in these types of cases to make sure not to inflame the passions of the jury and attack the defense in these situations, to make sure that the jury's looking at the evidence and doing their job without undue influence.
Counsel?
Yes.
Thank you. What do you make of the fact that the closing argument, when typed out into the transcript, was several pages long, I think somewhere around 20 pages long, and the statements that you point to as constituting prosecutorial misconduct or being disparaging really only amount to about a page out of that entirety?
That is true. It was a long trial, long closings, and however, the two misstatements or improper portions of the closing argument go to the heart of the evidence that we talked about in the first analysis about the sufficiency of the evidence. We're talking, and these statements were specifically targeting the lack of body fluid that the expert didn't see or didn't make note of, as well as no DNA from Mr. Pulley. So yes, although it's a small portion, that was the primary focus of the defense in this case. Anytime you have these types of cases, credibility certainly is at the core. And if the jury believes the accuser, well, then they're going to return a guilty verdict. So we don't oftentimes have this evidence to push back on the credibility, but that there was no other way, there was no explanation to that lack of evidence. And so when the state does what they can to disparage the defense or misstate the evidence so it shapes the mold of their prosecution, that's improper, especially when you look in the context of prosecutors having these other obligations, these ethical obligations of being ministers of justice and not just seeking out convictions. Looks like I'm running out of time. So for the reasons in my brief and what I've argued here, I'd ask that reverse the convictions, remand the matter to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we will turn to counsel for respondent next. The clock is reset, and you may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, and I represent the state of Minnesota as the respondent in today's matter. Now, as discussed by opposing counsel, there are two main legal challenges on appeal, one to the sufficiency of the evidence and one as to allegations of prosecutorial misconduct. Now, for my comments today, I'd like to focus on what I see as the three substantive issues that would dispose of those two challenges. First, with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence challenge, is that this court should apply the traditional standard of review for direct evidence, because when that is applied, based on this record and transcript, there is no justification for reversal. And second and third, with regard to the prosecutorial misconduct, as briefly mentioned in, by opposing counsel in the first oral argument section, is that there's just no basis for reversal based on either the alleged misstatements of fact or the alleged disparaging of the defense. Neither really happened or hold up to scrutiny when looking at the transcript. Now, turning to my first issue, I want to start where I think opposing counsel is quite clear on his oral argument. He said there is no question that the victim testified to all essential elements of the charges. That, in essence, concedes that this court should apply the stricter standard of review reserved for direct evidence. And the reason that is because, or the reason why that's important is because that is a stricter standard of review. This court must look at the evidence through the lens of most favorable to the state. It must look at the evidence through the lens most favorable to the jury verdict. And it must also presume that the jury believed the state's evidence and that it didn't, and that it disbelieved the defendants. And when you have a case like this, where you have the victim who personally testified to the abuse, in addition to corroborating evidence by a clinical therapist, a forensic scientist, his mother's boyfriend, that creates ample evidence to withstand a sufficiency challenge on appeal. Unless the court has any specific questions about the sufficiency, I can turn now to the alleged prosecutorial misconduct. There are two buckets, more or less, of allegations where the prosecutor committed alleged misconduct. The first would be that there were misstatements of fact. And within those buckets, there's kind of two at issue here. There's the DNA transference, and then the presence or lack thereof of ejaculate on the victim's clothes when they were tested. So with regard to the DNA on the underwear, I think it's key that what opposing counsel mentioned in oral argument is that there was testimony that there was skin-on-skin contact. That's undisputed. That's uncontested. But his skin was not the piece of evidence that was tested for the presence of DNA. It was his underwear. And there was testimony in the transcript, in the record, that talked about the transference of DNA. It talked about how the victim here wore a shirt to bed. It talked about how both the defendant and the victim wore pajamas to bed. And if you look at the transcript, it's mentioned in the closing argument as well as the transcript itself, is that when the prosecutor was asking the forensic scientist about how DNA transference works, she was using examples in the courtroom. She had a pen, and she said, if this is here, would it pick up my DNA? And this is all supported in the transcript. And the forensic scientist basically said, not necessarily. It's possible, but the idea is that you need a quantum of DNA transference in order for it to be detected on the piece of clothing. And that's really what's at issue here, is that it is uncontested based on the transcript and the record that there were potential barriers for the transference of DNA. And that's really what's at issue and what the prosecutor is saying in the closing.
So help me understand your argument then. The prosecutor's says the defendant testified and then goes on to say, what did he sleep in? Well, obviously a shirt. Perhaps his sleeve got in the way. If it wasn't the DNA put there, it's that the DNA is small enough, or because we don't live in the world of CSI, we cannot identify it to be the defendant. So help me understand how the sleeve got in the way is not a misstatement of the evidence when, going back to Helen's point about skin-on-skin contact, and, you know, wouldn't the hand touch the, logically, you know, if the sleeve's touching the underwear, wouldn't the hand as well? I guess I'm just not clear on how the sleeve got in the way is a misstatement of the evidence.
You know, absolutely, Your Honor. And I'm not going to sit here and say that that is the strongest argument that the state could have made. But I do want to go back to where you started with the, what did the prosecutor actually say? Because you, when you read it, it definitely reads, I would suggest, as if they are making a rational inference from the testimony that they heard. So, for instance, in the closing argument, the allegedly violative statements, the prosecutor says the defendant testified, what does he sleep in? DW, what does the defendant sleep in? He testified to both. And then the prosecutor goes on, well, obviously a shirt. But then this is the key part that I think is important. Perhaps his sleeve got in the way. It wasn't that there wasn't DNA on there. It's that the DNA is small enough, or because we don't live in a world of CSI. You see a prosecutor essentially saying, taking a rational inference, saying perhaps his sleeve got in the way. It's not the strongest argument to be made, but based on the fact that there was testimony in the record about there being a sleeve that could potentially be in the way, I would suggest that this falls squarely within the category of rational inferences or rhetorical devices that prosecutors are allowed to make in closing arguments. And again, at the end of this, the prosecutor wasn't hammering this home. The prosecutor said, go back to your notes, refer back to what you remember about the DNA transference, about the sleeves. I would suggest... Because, to answer your first question, my reading of this transcript is she's talking about DW's sleeve. I did not ask the line prosecutor about this. Obviously, I wasn't trial counsel, so I don't know what was in her head.
Right, and that was my reading of your brief. So then help me understand how a child's sleeve can get in the way of the DNA, how that relates to the DNA evidence.
I just think that what the prosecutor was doing here was making a rational inference argument, saying that it's entirely possible, given the fact that they wore pajamas or sleeves to bed, that there was something in the way that inhibited DNA transference. And as far as, you know, case support for that, I would draw this court's attention to State v. Bakken. It's a 2000 decision from this court. And I think that this, you know, paragraph sums up exactly the situation we have here. The evidence in this case was principally testimonial. The case depended entirely on who and what the jury believed. The jury heard competent evidence that supported conviction. The jury also heard competent evidence that supported acquittal. The jury resolved the conflict. And so I think what that goes back to is what Your Honor, Judge Braffold's question was, is that this really, as a sufficiency of evidence or a prosecutorial misconduct claim, it really boils down to a credibility challenge. And the jury already resolved that ambiguity.
And let me understand, counsel, the case law on prosecutorial misconduct. Of course, a prosecutor is not supposed to misstate the evidence. And I hear you arguing that there isn't a misstatement of the evidence. That at best what we have is a very bad inference being drawn by this prosecutor. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that the prosecutor did not affirmatively misstate the evidence in the record.
And maybe I misunderstand the appellant's argument. That could be so. But they'll get a chance to tell me that in rebuttal if they'd like to. Or maybe you want to correct me.
No, that's my understanding, Your Honor. It's the state's position that the prosecutor here did not affirmatively misstate. And, you know, perhaps... Drawing that to the standard of review here, we have to remember that we are under a modified plain error approach, where they have to show that the prosecutor intentionally misstated the evidence on the record. That is a pretty high burden. And even if there is some ambiguity, or if the argument was not very good or not very, you know, effective, that does not rise to the level of an intentional misstatement of fact. And then I would briefly turn to the last kind of bucket of prosecutorial misconduct that's alleged in this case, and that's that the prosecutor here was disparaging the defense. And I would...
Before we discuss that, can we turn back to the other alleged misstatement about the ejaculation?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I think
Yes, Your Honor. There was a through line in both direct and cross-examination of the victim here about when, how many times, and where he may have ejaculated from the molestation. That is just something that was asked by both parties. And in preparation of this, I realized that essentially my read of what the prosecutor was saying in closing is that it's unclear when this happened, but it's a red herring. It doesn't matter. The prosecutor's position in closing is if you believe the victim here, it doesn't matter exactly on what day, when, how many times he ejaculated. Because yes, Your Honor. I would say it's not a misstatement, and here's why. If you pull the direct testimony from the victim in the transcript and you compare it to the closing, you will see that they weren't clear. And so if I might, I have the three passages that I can pin cite for the court.
Yeah, and I looked at all of them, but please go through them.
So on page 134 of the transcript, you see the question, okay, in direct examination, say, did you ejaculate every time or just sometimes? He responds by saying, just sometimes. So now you have him saying that it happened more than once. On page 171 of the transcript, you see the cross-examination. And then in your most recent interview with the county, you indicated that, in fact, you did ejaculate and it was your first time ever ejaculating. He responds, yes. So already you have an inconsistency where he says it was his first time ejaculating the day before, which would have been the last incident, but he previously testified that it sometimes happened. And later on the redirect, on page 188 of the transcript, you see the question, so what did he say to you at least on one occasion in which you ejaculated? At least one occasion. He responded, he said, sorry, bud, I didn't mean to make you splurge. And that's what he was saying the defendant told him when he ejaculated. And so I take those pin sites out of the transcript because it is unclear. His testimony on this was not crystal clear. It's unclear whether he sometimes ejaculated. It's unclear whether the last time was the only time he ejaculated. And so compare that to the prosecutor's closing argument, where she says, we certainly don't know whether or not that moment he ejaculated that last time, so it was not tested for the semen. That makes sense. So we don't know if he ejaculated at that time or at a different time. That was unclear. I would submit to the court that given his inconsistencies in his testimony, that that's the prosecutor essentially saying to the jury, it was unclear. What do we know? We know that he testified that he ejaculated at least at some point in time, and that the testimony is not crystal clear that it was that last time or that the forensic scientist would have visibly noticed it on the underwear when she received it for testing for the DNA transference. And so in that sense, I would submit to the court that the prosecutor did not make a misstatement. Again, she was acknowledging that there was inconsistencies in testimony at trial, and she was asking the jury, in which it is the exclusive province for them to decide, the credibility of the victim. And then just briefly.
You're saying his testimony was inconsistent, but was he ever inconsistent as to whether he had ejaculated at that time? I mean, saying he ejaculated sometimes isn't inconsistent with saying he ejaculated at that time. And what she's saying there is we don't know if he ejaculated at that time or at a different time.
I would say if he testifies that he sometimes ejaculated, that is more than once. And that testimony saying that the last time that the abuse happened was the first time he ejaculated, I would say that that's inconsistent because if you sometimes ejaculate, that's more than once. And if the first time was on the last time, that would be inconsistent.
Yeah, I get that. I'll go back and look at it. I thought the sometimes statement was a little vague in terms of timing, but I'll go back.
Well, and taking a step back, It's a wise line of questioning because it was ambiguous. And that's kind of the point that the state is making, is that the prosecutor didn't come out saying he ejaculated once on this date, period. I would say that the transcript doesn't bear that out. The prosecutor also didn't come out saying he never ejaculated or he only ejaculated for the first time and the last time. She didn't make these clear statements of fact because they weren't clear. It was ambiguous. It was inconsistent. And, you know, I would suggest it's not unreasonable to imagine why a young prepubescent teenager testifying on at trial about his father figure doing this to him, why it would be inconsistent or why it wouldn't be crystal clear. But that, again, boils down to a credibility determination that the jury made in hearing the state's evidence and hearing the defendant's evidence. And then with my brief time remaining with the disparaging defense, I would like to draw attention to what opposing counsel said in oral argument here, where he said that he concedes that red herring, saying that an argument is a red herring, is an appropriate argument for the state to make. I would say that that, in essence, resolves the dispute here. That's what the prosecutor said. She said that this discussion about the presence or lack thereof of ejaculate on the underwear is a red herring, because it was. It doesn't matter if there was ejaculate on the underwear. It doesn't matter if it was tested and returned a positive or negative. What matters is whether the jury believed the victim when he testified about the abuse. And given the record that we have, his direct testimony and the corroborating evidence in the record, the state submits that the court should affirm it on both the sufficiency of the evidence and find that the prosecutor did not commit misconduct in closing arguments. Thank you.
And attorney for appellant, we have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may begin when you are ready.
The case that I was thinking of is as far as the lack of body fluids in this garment that was tested is the State versus Wright case, 679 Northwest 2nd 186. That's a case from this court in 2004. The summary of that case is that the accuser, the victim in that case, did not contend that Wright ejaculated during the sexual assault, so the absence of semen in her body or on the floor of the bathroom is not wholly exculpatory. This case is different than the Wright case. And my reading of the Wright case is that there may be some situations like a case like this where the absence of the evidence is in fact evidence that the jury can consider of innocence or of not guilty when weighing whether the state has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And when we look at the context of these arguments of the state and either the inartful arguments or the ambiguities involved in the evidence, these are the two issues, again, that go directly to the heart of the allegations in this case and whether they can be corroborated. And they attempted to corroborate this testimony. And when you look at it, the grand scheme of things and the big picture, when you have this contradictory evidence, the defense's argument is that the jury didn't act with due regard to this presumption of innocence and that they, for whatever reason, were not rational in their decision-making. And that's all I have, unless you have more questions. Thank you.
So thank you for your time. The case is submitted. We have, thank you for appearing today and for your briefs and your argument. We will take everything under consideration and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeline. So, thank you very much. And with that, the court is in recess for 15 minutes.
All right.